Coming up during this edition of On Your Money, certified financial planner Kevin McKinley has some healthy advice to keep our finances in good shape and some information on how the just upheld Affordable Care Act may affect our pocketbooks. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July 3rd. Would you like a tip or two on your spending or saving habits? Do you have a question about money matters for Kevin? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Did you survive the storms that rumbled through western Wisconsin?
We did. We have a house with a roof.
That is handy.
So we were okay. Yeah, we cost extra, but we figured it was worth it. In times like this, it really pays off.
Well, I wish we could get some of that rain in southern Wisconsin. It is super dry here, and as you know, western and southern Wisconsin under excessive heat warnings through 10 o'clock on Friday night. 100 degrees plus in southern Wisconsin today. I think we're going to pass 100 degrees again on Thursday. This is something else. And I thought that, Kevin, just as sort of an ongoing maybe fun thing to do to beat the heat during On Your Money, we could ask listeners to share some inexpensive beat the heat suggestions. What do you think?
Sure. If someone wants to call in, email in with their inexpensive. I don't get this, because it'd be one thing if we could be promised that in return for living through 20 below winters, that the temperature would never get above 80 degrees or so in the summer. That would seem like a fair deal to me. But we're right now 120 degrees above what it was in February and is going to be again in another 7 months. It just doesn't seem right.
And it is summer, and we know it's supposed to be hot, but this is going on a bit long. Anyway, let's talk about the recent Supreme Court decision on the health care laws that may or may not be bumping up our income tax bill, Kevin.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of confusion on this, in part because part of the reason that it was upheld was because it was viewed as a tax rather than a penalty, and then it's not a tax, but it is a penalty. And now, in a rare show of bipartisan agreement, both Mitt Romney and President Obama have agreed that this is not a tax. However, it is going to affect some people's income tax bills, but not to the degree that some people might believe, and certainly even those it does affect probably won't affect it very much.
Well, who is going to have higher taxes because of this?
It will generally be people making more than $200,000 if they are single filers, or $250,000 for married couples filing jointly, and that is adjusted gross income, and that's usually the figure at the bottom of the 1040 form. Now, that's about 3% of American households or so, according to the U.S. Census. And, you know, you get a lot of emails from that crazy uncle forwarded to you about, you know, how terrible this is. One of the things they put in there is how they're going to start taxing the gains on the sale of your home. Well, yes, there will be a tax, but it will only apply to the amount that you receive that's above either the regular exempt amount of $250,000 to $500,000 of profits on the sale of your home.
So how is this tax going to be applied?
The first tax will be a Medicare tax. You know, a lot of us pay 1.45% of our salary for Medicare, and then the boss kicks in another 1.45 for a total of 2.9%. Well, starting in 2013, there'll be another 0.9% added to that amount. But again, it's only for adjusted gross incomes over $200,000 for single filers and $250,000 for married couples filing jointly. And how this works out, and the numbers are still being kicked around, but a couple that files jointly and has about $300,000 of adjusted gross income a year, their Medicare tax will increase by probably about $500 or so.
And what's the other way?
There'll be a higher tax on investment income that will be a 3.8% bump on top of what people are already paying. This is dividends, interest, rent, some capital gains depending on the situation, but it also requires the kicker of the adjusted gross income of $200,000 single and $250,000 for married couples filing jointly. It's going to be tricky for a lot of reasons, one of which is that you know, not only are there triggers for this different tax that don't apply to everybody, but we have the expiration of certain tax legislation that may or may not be extended coming at the end of the year and coming on the heels of a really big election. And so that might play differently into this as time goes on.
And there are some other taxes also associated with the law?
Some much smaller ones that may affect a very few amount of individuals. There's a cap on those flexible spending accounts, the amount of money that can be put into those. Those are the use it or lose it accounts that some people still use. I don't think they're a great idea, but some people like them. There's also a higher bar for itemizing and deducting medical expenses. It used to be 7.5% of adjusted gross income, and now it's 10% of adjusted gross income. And then finally, there'll be an extra penalty on withdrawals from a healthcare savings account that are not used for qualified healthcare expenses. It used to be 10%, and it's going to be 20% if you just pull the money out of that and use it to, you know, buy a new air conditioner.
And I could use a new air conditioner. We are talking about your money, and we're also talking a little bit about this heat. Maybe you have an inexpensive beat the heat suggestion that you would like to share during this edition of On Your Money, or maybe you have another personal finance question for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234. We would like to hear it. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Oh, yeah. It is time for the On Your Money email bag, and a listener has been asking Kevin for your thoughts on long-term care insurance and whether you think it's a good idea to buy it or not. What is it?
One of the things I'm hesitant to answer this question is because we've moved away from people getting their questions answered in response to false praise for the show and specifically me, and now they're just repeatedly asking the question. But because it is such a sensitive topic and so many people are concerned about it, we will address it. But people, you are much more likely to get your questions aired and answered on the show if you preface the question with false praise for the show and specifically me. Let's get this straight. Read the memo.
Very good.
Right now, long-term care in Wisconsin, private nursing home room costs about $7,000 per month. A semi-private one cost about $6,000 per month. An assisted living facility, your own room, cost about $3,500 per month. And what happens is a lot of people around the age of 55 to 65 are dealing this with a parent and are noticing how fast the money goes and are wondering if they should get this for themselves. But people hate to buy this insurance because they don't feel like they're ever going to get something out of it. And they're probably right. It's unlikely that most people are going to spend an extended period of time in one of these facilities. But if you witness it up close, you see how damaging it can be, especially from a financial standpoint. The people who should consider purchasing this kind of insurance are generally those who have between $200,000 and $2 million in paper net worth, liquid assets. If you have less than that, you probably can't afford the premiums. And if you have more than that, you can probably afford to pay for it out of pocket. That said, even if you're not in that spectrum, if it's something that owning this policy makes you feel good and gives you a sense of relief, it's probably something that you should still consider.
So you said between $200,000 and $2 million in liquid assets?
In liquid assets. This would be IRAs, savings, mutual funds, stocks. Again, less than that, probably can't afford it. More than that, you should just self-insure and plan on paying for it out of pocket. One thing I would definitely caution people against, and we get a lot of calls about this, is trying to impoverish yourself so that you can qualify for public assistance. That's very difficult to do. There are a lot of downsides to doing it. And even if you do it, there's no guarantee that the kind of care care that you will be able to get from public assistance would be the level that you might want. And so you should at least look for either from your own assets or an insurance policy like this rather than trying to go through that impoverishment process. Yeah.
Seems like there would be a lot of people who would meet that criteria.
Yeah, there will. That fits just about everybody. The different way to look at this, a lot of people buy this when they're 60, or at least they consider buying it when they're 60 in the hopes that it will be there when they're 85. And that's really the wrong way to look at it. Or they're worried that they'll pay in all this money to it and they'll die in their sleep in their own bed at the age of 90, which is what most of us, how we would like to go. Don't look at it this way. Look at it instead of a 30-year protection plan. Look at it for 30 days, meaning once you get the long-term care insurance, you have it. The premium is due in 30 days. If you want the insurance and you can afford the premium, you make the payment, and then you've got 30 new days of coverage. You know, a lot of people who are worried about not using this, you should look at this in the same way you look at your homeowner's insurance, meaning that, the year goes by and your house doesn't burn down. Nobody says, darn it, we paid all that money in homeowners insurance and our house never burned out. Be glad that your house didn't burn down and you didn't have to cash in the policy. And by the same token, be glad that you don't have to enter a facility and cash in the long-term care insurance.
So what kind of policy would you recommend people consider?
Most people should probably look at something that's almost like a catastrophic long-term care insurance policy, meaning one that has a very high deductible and a longer payout period, and basically trying to insure their situation against Alzheimer's and dementia, because most people who do enter these facilities without those conditions either pass away fairly soon, or they get back out and go back home again. Generally, you want to have at least $5,000 per month of coverage and have it for about 5 years. That will typically cost about $200 to $400 per month per person on the policy. But if you want to compare some policies and see some numbers, you can go to longtermcare.gov to get a very good background on it. And then the Wisconsin Office of Commissioner of the Insurance has another great page on long-term care insurance, and we'll have links to those websites at both of our websites, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right, and are there any alternatives to buying long-term care insurance?
Sure. The long-term care insurance is still the best way to solve this potential problem. But one thing people can do is if they have a paid-up life insurance policy, you might want to keep that in force. And you can either use the cash value or the eventual proceeds to offset the cost to the estate. Some people I know have taken out a 30-year mortgage right now and said, I'm parking that money. And I figured out that if I pay, let's say, 4% interest on it, but I'm earning 2 or 3% on CDs, the difference in the cost of that is the same what I'd pay for long-term care insurance on a premium. But this way, I'll just kind of earmark that money for long-term care and not have to pay into the insurance for it. You can also get a reverse mortgage or a home equity line of credit on a reverse mortgage if there is going to be one person of a couple remaining at home. And, there are other options out there. There's an insurance policy out there that allows you to put a deposit in, earn a little bit of interest, and then if you either need it for life insurance, it's, let's say, four times your deposit. And if you need it for long-term care, it might pay for 2 to 4 times of your deposit in payback for long-term care. Those are a little trickier. I prefer if you are going to cover this need through insurance, you buy a policy specifically designed for this need, no more, no less.
I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, we welcome it. And if you have a question for Kevin, maybe you also, at the same time, will have a suggestion for us on how to beat this heat with this excessive heat warning posted for much of southern and western Wisconsin through Friday. 1-800-642-1234 or email us onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Greenback, greenback paper bill. Yes, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley with information and advice on your money. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call with your question about money matters for Kevin. And if you can think of one, tell us a tip that you use, an inexpensive tip to beat the heat. And, Kevin, we did have Nettie in Fond du Lac who called, who says, put your feet in a bucket of cold water. So what do you think of that?
Is that a cooling tip or is that an insult?
I don't, both.
Okay, all right. You just like take a long walk off a short pier. Thank you, Nettie. I will try that at the office later on today.
My solution is popsicles. Popsicles.
Put your feet in a bucket of popsicles.
Yeah, there we go.
That seems expensive. It probably works.
Popsicles are a good, inexpensive way to cool down. Dan in Denmark has a real money question. Hello, Dan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Most Honorable Monsignor McKinley. I bow to your excellency.
All right, Dan, we got the rest of the hour for you. Anything you want to ask, fire away.
I'm looking at refinancing my home, and I know you've said in the past a 30-year mortgage is more logical than a 15-year, but the 15-year offers almost a whole percentage point less in interest. Should I still go with the 30-year?
Well, the reason I like the 30-year is because it does buy you more flexibility. It also buys you a higher interest charge over the 30 years, obviously, both in terms of rate and dollars paid. But it also, if you stick with a 15-year, the 15-year gets you a much higher minimum payment, and even with the lower interest rate. What I would do, Dan, is figure out the break-even point where if you said, hey, if I take the 30-year mortgage out but make the payment that the 15-year were to require, how long would I still take to pay this thing off? And my guess is it's probably going to be about 16 years or so. For my money, if that's the number for my money, I would still have you take the 30-year out because you can always pay it off faster if you want, and because you're making that higher payment, you're shortening the time that you are paying interest, and you're whittling down the principal faster. That's really where the advantage comes with the 15-year. It's usually not in the interest rate, but I understand. If people say the only way that I'm going to refinance is if I can guarantee to be done with this thing at 15 years, then definitely go ahead and get the 15-year. But if you do get the 30-year, there are so many other things that are likely to cost you more in interest in the future, whether it's a car loan, student loan. We also might see a case where interest rates go up and the money that you've borrowed from the bank, you could be paying less in interest than you're earning on safer investments like CDs or savings bonds. So again, I still default to the 30-year, but if you say the only way I can do this is to get a 15, go ahead and get the 15.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Dan, you don't have any more questions? You can have the whole hour, you know.
My tip for beating the heat is turn on the air conditioner.
We get a pen here, Dan. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to jot this down.
Thank you very much, Dan. Smart aleck. John in Crivitz is with us. Hi, John.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
Kevin, thanks for being on the air. Great show. Question, I'm looking for a loan for my son to go to college, and I know on the news recently that the government extended the tax rate for 1 year to 3.4. What loans actually does that 3.4 qualify for?
Yeah, those are usually subsidized Stafford loans that hit that. And people should generally borrow first to pay for college costs and use savings last, because you don't know if the loan will be available in future years, and you don't know if it will be available at the current terms. If it is, you're in great shape. If not, you'll be very glad that you set savings aside and in reserve so that you could not only either pay for costs or make the payments that the initial loan are required to pay off. And with the philosophy from a political and legislative standpoint is kind of moving toward federal loans of saying once kids get out of school, if they can make minimum payments on these things for a long time, there may be some forgiveness opportunities down the road. I'd rather have you start with those the Stafford loans, if you can, even the unsubsidized ones, which do charge a higher interest rate. There still are some attractive features to those. And again, you're much better off using loans first and savings last to pay for college. Now, is it your son, you said?
Yes, my son will be going to college in August. He needs about $30,000 per year. And I guess the base of my question is, because I'm just getting into this, there is a Parent Plus loan, and then there's unsubsidized loans. Is there a way I can try to get an unsubsidized loan from the Fed for 30 grand, or am I stuck going the other route.
You might not be able to get it. There are limits on the amount of money that you can get for that. You might have to go with Parent Plus, which isn't the end of the world. I think you're probably – are you seeing an interest rate of like maybe 7.9% on the Parent Plus? Is that what that is now?
That is correct.
Okay. Did you fill out the FAFSA, the financial aid form yet? You did do that. Okay. That's the first thing. And people, by the way, you should fill that out on January 2nd before the fall in which your kid is going to go to college. You should do that for every January 2nd because some of this aid is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. So let me ask you this, John, in allusion to the previous caller, have you do you have a new mortgage that you've refinanced for your home as well?
Yes, I do, Kevin.
Okay, good. That's the first step you should do as well is get that home equity tapped because those are much better terms. But offhand, I'd rather have you move through the Stafford first, the subsidized first, then the unsubsidized, and then if you still need to cover it, get the Parent Plus loan. Because even with that, there are still some things that can help you out and mitigate the cost of college. I'd much rather have you, you know, kick the can down the road for a few months or years and worry about paying it off then rather than, you know, depleting $30,000 of your savings if that's all you have to cover not only college costs but also any other lifetime emergencies that come up in the meantime.
Well, thanks for your comments.
All right, John, thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Good luck to you and your son. Lori in Menominee Falls is with us next. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin. Kevin, I will gravel in any way you want, so I
can. Oh, it is hot in here.
You were talking about long-term care insurance, and mm-hmm. it coincided with a major thing that happened yesterday to my husband and me. We have bought long-term care insurance. We are both in our 60s. We bought it when we turned 60, just as you said. It's a very good policy. We have paid faithfully. It comes up in August. So it's a very timely question for us. Yesterday we received a letter from our insurance company that said our premium was going to increase by, brace yourself, 90%.
Wow. Mm.
And how nice of them to let us know. And of course now we are faced with this dilemma. Is it worth it? That would bring our combined payment to approximately $7,000.
Per year.
Per year,
right.
Correct.
Right.
What is your reaction to this? Of course, we'll call the insurance company. They haven't called us back yet.
Yeah, well, a couple things about that. First of all, it's disappointing. Second of all, according to my quick math here, that's going to work out to about maybe $275 each per month for that mm-hmm. premium, right? And mm-hmm. that's actually... and this is going to disturb a lot of people, that's on the low end, I think, of a good... I'm worried when people say, no, I have a long-term care insurance policy. It costs me $18 a month. I said, I don't know what you're doing with that $18, but it's not buying you a long-term care insurance policy. That's probably a good policy. They're not targeting you. Generally, when companies raise the premiums on long-term care insurance, they have to raise it on a class of people. And the reason that they're hesitant to do that, they say, well, why don't they just keep raising this up, is because the people who are in very good health and don't see any need in the near-term future for this type of care say, you know what, the heck with you. We're not paying this. You can't do this to us. And they drop off. Those of us who, you know, can't remember what we had for breakfast 20 minutes ago said, you know what, I'm probably going to need this by Christmas. I better keep paying this policy. And the insurance company ends up with a very adverse pool of policy owners that they are going to end up paying a lot of money with. So they're doing this probably on a hesitant basis rather than, oh boy, it's bonuses for everybody. That said, I would still shop around, take another look around, and see if you can find another provider that offers the same kind of care. You're still at a fairly young age for this insurance. But I would say that's not an outrageous price, the $270 or so a month per person. There are some ways some policies offer couples, married couples, substantial discounts if they each buy a policy, about 30 or 40% or so.
Oh.
So that's one way to cut it. But then again, you have to know that the policy that the company's going to be around to pay it when you want it. But I'd keep paying it, but I'd start looking at other providers, and you'll either find something that's less expensive and more suitable, or you'll say, you know what, this is actually a pretty good deal. If we want this coverage and we can afford it, we should probably keep paying it.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. The only question I was encouraged to ask was to the insurance company was, can they do this again?
Yes.
And
they can and they will.
good.
Yeah, they can and they will. Again, they're going to be hesitant to do that because they can't just sit and jack up the premiums for whatever they feel like because of those very reasons. But yeah, the prices are, like a lot of kinds of healthcare insurance, are only going to go up, and so it is a case of saying, well, is this the best option for us? If it is and we still want it and can afford it, we will. If not, and again, look upon it as a 30-day proposition, not for something to say, gosh, we're going to be doing this for 85 until we're 85 years old.
Yeah. Well, that was a very good thing for you to say. I really listened to it when you said that the first time. Thanks so much. And I do have a tip.
Good.
Okay.
You get a dog, you put a pool in the backyard, you let the dog splash around in the pool, and then you let the dog shake itself all over you.
There we go. That's really cheap.
And for those of you at work, same thing. Bring the dog in, get it all wet, and, you know, maybe help a coworker out.
All right, Lori, thank you very much for that creative beat the heat tip and for your question. Good luck to you. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin about your personal finances, or if you have a beat the heat tip, we appreciate that as well. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and it's time now, Kevin, for our Smart Assets segment of the show. And you say that we're going to be getting some new information on our retirement plans at work, but it's not going to tell us how to save more money into the plan?
No, it's going to tell you how to save more on the assets that you currently have in your retirement plan at work, like your 401k or your 403b. It's coming down from the Department of Labor, and they are very concerned that there are 72 million workers in America with $3 trillion in their retirement plans at work, and these people have absolutely no idea what the assets are being charged in terms of expenses on what the mutual funds or stable accounts or money markets have. And even if people do know the cost, it's one thing to actually find the information. It's another thing to compare it and figure out how to reduce those costs once we're able to ascertain that information. It's going to come by about April 30th. You're going to get a notice that says, here are the actual costs of the funds in your plan. And then every year they're going to update you with that information as well.
Well, so what are these costs and why are they there?
Well, it's not something that you actually pay. Typically, they don't bill you and say, we deducted $1,212 from your account, but they are incurred. The expenses go to manage the money for the administrative expenses and the commission costs if someone has sold people the plan as well. And they generally run around 1% per year, depending on the plan and the assets. So let's say all of your money that's invested in a plan earned a gross return of 7%. After the 1% is deducted by the insurance or mutual fund or financial services company, you get 6%. And if you lose 10% on those assets, then you actually lose 11% after the 1% is deducted.
I suppose 1% it doesn't sound like a whole lot.
No, it doesn't. But there are cheaper alternatives out there. There are a lot of index funds that the expenses are half of that or less. And the 1% can really add up for people who are saving over the long term. Let's say a person is putting aside $5,000 per year in her retirement plan at work, and she's doing it for 30 years. If she nets out 7% on that money, she'll have about almost $500,000 after 30 years. But if she only nets out 6%, she'll have about $400,000 or so. So a little bit off the top every single year can really make a big difference.
Yeah, it can. So how can I find out, or how can workers find out how much they're currently paying in expenses for these funds in their retirement plans?
The information is there. You can understand why the companies are reticent to give you this right in your face, but it's in the documentation that you receive, and a lot of times it's in the year-end statement or the performance summary in the far right corner of the page. They'll show you what the internal expenses are. Stock funds generally should be less than 1%. mixed funds like balanced or target date or asset allocation funds should definitely be less than 0.75%, and bond funds should be less than 0.5% or 0.5% per year in expenses. Now, if you want to find out right now, if you can get the name of your fund, you can find it and then go to Morningstar.com and amongst several other different providers, and they'll give you the internal expense. So you can see not only what your fund is charging you, but also if it's too expensive.
And even once we find out these expenses, though, Kevin, aren't a lot of workers usually limited to a small menu of investment options?
That's part of the problem, is that, you know, you might have 12 or 15 different funds from which to choose, and a lot of times those funds aren't the ones that you would choose if you were to do it. So what I would recommend is develop an overall mix between any money you have in a plan at work and then any money you have outside of that, like in your savings or your own IRAs or Roth IRAs, and then try to find the best option within your plan with the lowest expense, and then find another complementary option that has an even lower expense yet, like an index fund. And Vanguard has those. They're usually the leader, but there are other ones out there that provide that. Or, you know, if you're not getting a match at work on your contribution and you're contributing less than $5,000 or $6,000 and you trust yourself to make the contribution, you might be better off just going with your own self-directed IRA, because you can still put the money in. Then you can choose from literally thousands of different mutual fund and investment options, and you can control the fund choice and the expenses much better that way.
Sounds good. We have an email from a listener with a 401k related question. Rick in Baraboo emails. This is funny. First off, Kevin is a genius. Secondly,
obviously not a long time listener to the show.
Secondly, I am 55 years old and I have $400,000 in a 401k. I have a retirement from a previous job that is offering a payout of $60,000. After taxes, I would get $35,000. Should I take this and pay off credit cards, or wait and get $900 a month at age 64?
55, so you've got to wait 9 years, carry seven.
That is kind of complicated.
Train leaves Cucamonga at 2 o'clock. Offhand, I would say, I bet there's a third option here. And thank you, Rick, for the kind, if improper praise. There's a third option here, and I bet it is he can take that lump sum and probably roll it into an IRA and not pay taxes on it right now. And that's probably what he should do. If he can do it. Waiting 10 years, and especially if it's a private company, to pay off a pension, to start paying in 10 years, that's a pretty big bet. In the meantime, if they are indeed credit cards, he might be paying interest that's closer to 14 to 20% interest. And it will feel good to pay it off. From a paper standpoint, my first choice would be for Rick to roll that lump sum into a qualified IRA so that he doesn't have to pay taxes on it. If that's not feasible, my next recommendation is that if he is indeed paying a higher interest rate, yeah, go ahead, pull it out, pay the taxes, watch out for penalties as well, because he is under the normal retirement age for penalty-free withdrawals from retirement plans. Watch out for taxes and then use it to pay off the credit cards. And then my last choice would be to do nothing and hope that both he and the pension are around 10 years from now to start paying him his $900, because it's going to take only 5 years or so for him to get that money back. So if he can get it from 65 to 70, throwing out the time value money for the time being, he will get his $50,000 back that way, and then anything extra on top of that is gravy.
Thanks for the email, Rick. Hope that helps. We will take more of your questions for Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley in just a few moments. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Herdeen. This is the Ideas Network.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And in this week's Shop Around segment, some news about a major telecommunications provider who has a new monthly pricing method. And Kevin, you say for better or worse?
Well, it's the new Share Anything plan from Verizon, which I'm very uncomfortable with emails, web browsing, text that's entitled share anything.
Yeah.
I don't wish to share anything with anyone. It basically gives people unlimited calls and texts. But you pay every month for the device, and you also pay for data, web browsing, downloads, etc. They're basically giving up on charging people for the low-cost stuff like voice and text, but making you pay more for not only having the device on the plan, but also for using the data. It does allow you to share the data among up to 10 devices. And Verizon's the largest provider. Typically, these providers kind of allow one company to launch a plan and then see how they do and then predicate their own decisions based on the success or failure of that particular pricing option. So it's definitely something that even if you're not a Verizon customer, you want to pay attention to this.
Yeah, I am a Verizon customer, and I haven't been paying attention to this. How much would this cost?
Well, there's a flat fee, and it's $40 per month for your smartphone, $30 for your dumb phone, if you will, and then $10 for any tablet that you have, like an Android tablet or an iPad. The data costs are $50 for 1 gigabyte, and then another, you can get $100, will get you a 10 gigabyte plan, and if you go over that, you can buy another 2 gigs for $10 or so every single month.
All right, so how much does a gigabyte get me?
It depends on the on what you're actually downloading, but according to AT&T, it should get you several thousand emails, a few thousand web pages, streaming music or radio audio about 20 hours. Where they really hope to get people and really make their money is on any video streaming or downloading. TV shows might get you 2 hours of television, and movies are usually more are bigger files. So that might get you one movie for the whole month. Verizon will alert you that you're about to go over and give you an opportunity to make sure that you don't end up with a $6,000 bill because your 8-year-old was watching My Little Pony or whatever the show is.
So what if Verizon customers don't like this new plan?
As of now, current customers can keep their old plan. If they do switch to the new plan, they cannot go back. Also, let's say you have an iPhone on a Verizon contract and you want to upgrade to the 4, 5, or 12, or whatever the next thing is down the road. You either have to go on the new plan or you have to pay the full price for the new phone. Instead of a subsidized cost that might be $100 or $200, you'll pay $500 to $600 for the new phone to stay on your old plan. And that might still be worth it for you, especially if you have unlimited data. You might want to check around with AT&T and T-Mobile and some of the other ones to see if they have a plan that's more competitive for your specific uses. But keep in mind that this is not just about cost. It's also about coverage. So if you're going to be using the device in a lot of different areas, you might want to check and make sure that provider is just as strong in that particular area. They might, AT&T and other larger ones may follow Verizon, and they may not. So even if you do switch, you don't know that you might end up being priced under the same terms a year down the road.
I better look into that. So thank you very much, Kevin. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And remember, we're looking for your questions for Kevin, but if you have a beat the heat tip, that's welcome as well, as we are under this excessive heat warning for western and southern Wisconsin until 10 o'clock on Friday night, and the rest of the state's not going to be all that cool either. So how are you coping with the heat wave? How do you beat the heat? Gloria in Waukesha. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. I love listening to Kevin. He's just so intelligent and
very
makes
good.
Me feel like I'm doing the right thing.
Perfect, Gloria. Perfect.
This is great. People are actually buying into this. I just love that. Really starts my day off right. So thank you, Gloria.
Beat the heat. I go in the basement with a fan.
Good idea. All right, Gloria. Now we will answer, or Kevin will answer your question.
Okay. My husband turned 70 years old on New Year's Eve. He needs to take an RMD.
What's an RMD?
Is that like a medication or?
No. What RMD? Retirement minimum.
Oh, yes, you're right. Okay. Required minimum distribution from his IRA account, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's $9,000. So, he's still working.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know he gets till 2013 to withdraw, April of 2013.
Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb is he has to take it out by April 1st of the year after he turns 70 and a half. You can tell this was created by the government because there's no, it's even difficult to describe, much less follow it. But he'll turn 70 and a half in 2013. Is that correct, Gloria?
Yes.
Okay. Technically, he then does not have to take the money out until April 1st of 2014. That's the good news. The bad news is he then has to take another RMD, a required minimum distribution, in that calendar year of 2014. So, and that's probably going to be even higher than the $9,000. So all of the things being equal, he would have to take $9,000 out on April 1st of 2014 and then another $9,500, I'm guessing, by the end of 2014. So he's going to have to double up for that first year.
Okay. Now for the question.
All right.
In 2014, which is a year he can take his first deduction and has to take a second deduction.
Withdrawal, RMD, right.
What year do we pay taxes on the first deduction and the second deduction?
You pay taxes on it for the year in which you take it. So if you don't take it out until 2014, you don't pay the taxes on. Well, you might have quarterly estimates or something, but technically the taxes won't be owed until the following April 15th. So if you waited until 2014 to take those two RMDs, Gloria, the taxes in theory wouldn't be due until April 15th of 2015, which sounds like a long ways away, but it'll come sooner than we all want it to.
Well, hopefully he'll be retired by then. He's still working.
Right. Okay. What I would recommend you do is, first of all, think about spreading those out. Second of all, check line 43 on your 1040. If that dollar amount, you want to keep that below $70,700 if you can, because if you can keep that amount either by putting the withdrawals into two in 1 year or one in 2013 and one in 2014, if you can keep that number below that, you'll stay in the 15% federal tax bracket. If you go over that amount, you'll be in the 25% federal tax bracket. That's a big difference. It's 10%, obviously. So that could be an extra $1,000 in taxes that you and he would have to pay that you wouldn't have to if you can split it between 2013 and 2014.
Good luck to you, Gloria. Thanks very much for your false praise and your beat the heat tip. Emily in Dodgeville has been waiting. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I'm really excited to talk to both of you. I'm a student, and I'm going on to get my bachelor's degree in the fall. I just graduated my associate's degree, so now I'm facing the unsubsidized, the subsidized, and the Parent PLUS loan. And this is my first time dealing with loans because I paid for my first degree out of pocket. So I'm trying to decide how much do I take out. Like, they're offering me more than I need to accept. And I'm also hearing from a local bank, they have a loan I can take out also, which has a lower interest. So I'm wondering how much of these loans do I accept and if there are any benefits going with a federal loan versus one from a local bank.
Great questions, Emily. And congratulations, first of all, on your associate degree. Second of all, on working with it. You're doing this in the right way of just kind of piecing this off, biting off what you can chew every single year, both in terms of cost and in terms of credit. So good for you. You'll be much happier doing this way than just trying to get, you know, barely 18-year-olds to make a decision that's going to cost $200,000, I think, is lunacy for families. So I'm glad you're doing this that way. Are you guaranteed with, let me ask you about this bank loan. Are you guaranteed of getting a specific interest rate? Or if they said, hey, you can get this rate, but you have to apply for it, of course, and to get it, you have to qualify for it.
Well, I got a letter in the mail from a local bank, and it says that I qualify for a loan with this, like, 3.4% interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, but, and then the Parent PLUS loan is, like, I believe it's 7.9, which I think you mentioned earlier. So I wasn't sure if I should investigate farther with this local bank or if there's benefits with a federal loan. I wasn't sure.
I'd prefer you start with the federal loans and go through that, but I would also check into it. There are some private loans out there. The private student lending market is getting more competitive, and some lenders do offer private loans that are actually lower interest costs than federal loans. However, there can be catches on there. There can be terms that either are hidden or not explained fully to you. There can be things that can change, and you will have a very difficult time getting any type of private loan written off down the road. The federal loans are as part of the income-based repayment plan that some people have available to them. The loans can be forgiven after many, many years of regular payments, or if you get out of school and your income isn't high enough, it's easier to knock your payment down to a more affordable level with the federal loans, those Stafford loans, than it is to do it with a private loan and especially a Parent Plus loan. So the order I would go is subsidized Stafford, unsubsidized Stafford, Parent Plus, and then private. Unless you find out that you've got great credit and you really understand the terms of the loan, I would even have a lawyer. I'd pay a few hundred bucks to a lawyer to have them look at the contract, especially from the private loan, to see if it is really the way it's being portrayed to you.
Okay, and then they're offering me more with the unsubsidized parent and subsidized loan. They're offering me more than I need to take. How much of that should I accept?
Offhand, if you trust yourself to pocket that money and just not spend it on anything you'll regret, I tell you to take all you can get. If you are self-actualized enough, Emily, to know that you're going to blow it and regret it, I'd say just take what you need and then worry about the future in the future.
Okay, and you would advise if you trust yourself to take it all just because then you have that money to pay back as you need, or?
Yep, it can pay for anything once you have it. You can make the payments on the loans you're already incurring. You can use it to cover living expenses. A lot of people get in the lurch for, you know, they lose a job or they have a car repaired that they need to get back and forth to school. If you have that money, you can spend it. It's hard to borrow it at that point, especially if you are a student, because by definition, you don't have a whole lot of income, and so lenders aren't really excited about giving you a loan that's not for higher education expenses.
So, Emily, are you saying you would not blow that money?
I would not. I am pretty responsible.
Well, thank you so much. We're at near the end of the program. I want to thank you very much, Emily, for your call. A real quick one from Sue, who emails, I love your show, and it's good to have you two back together. That's right. We've been on some vacation schedules here. Our very last house payment is tomorrow. My husband is worried about not having the tax deduction. How badly will this impact our taxes?
Not at all, especially if the mortgage balance is very small, because then the interest is going to be very small. And if you, unless you itemize and have a large amount of deductions and interest, it's usually better off to just pay it off. I like mortgages for the liquidity purposes, but generally the tax break is not a reason to get the new mortgage.
All right. So the website of the week, Kevin.
It's Onavo, onavo.com. They let you download a free app that lets you monitor your usage for both your iPhone and your Android device. And you can even control it, track it, and extend it by compressing the data. Helps you make sure that you don't go over your allotted usage. Onavo.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. later on today.
So besides sticking your feet in a bucket of cold water and going into the basement and turning on the fan and having the dog shake off the pool water on you, what are you going to do to beat the heat today?
I'm going to shut all the shades at work and at home. That helps do it. I'm also going to cover up the air conditioning vents in the lower level of the house so that the upper level gets more cool air, which then comes down and recirculates. So that helps us save a little bit. But yeah, it's not the heat, it's the stupidity.
Thank you, Kevin. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And Kevin will be with us again next week for another edition of On Your Money. And this program is also repeated every Tuesday evening between 9 and 10. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Naya Mukherjee for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.